In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. The big ideas of today will become market-leading companies in the near future, reimagining every sector of the global economy for the better. Climate, healthcare, food, transportation, housing, energy, and more. Welcome to Obvious Ideas, a podcast exploring the transformation of the fundamental building blocks of life and society. I'm Andrew Beebe, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures. We just wrapped up our 8-part series on climate, where we dug into the biggest opportunities for founders and professionals in any industry to tackle our climate crisis. In this bonus episode, we're flipping the script. I'm sitting down with Emily Brady, Editorial Director at Obvious Ventures. She's going to interview me about my takeaways from the season and, of course, the obvious ideas of the future that may seem crazy today. Welcome, Emily. Thanks for joining us. I'll let you take it away.
Thanks, Andrew. I'm excited to switch roles with you today. Let's jump in. So, Andrew, you spoke with a nuclear scientist, an official at the Department of Energy, the inventor of the iPod and iPhone, a journalist turned investor, among others. And I'm just wondering, like, what themes stood out to you?
Well, I guess it's hard to pick just one, Emily. I always love talking to folks that I know well, like Tony Fadell and Jigar Shah. But I think I would call out two other folks, Rachel Slabon and Nan Rantzehoff. Both really helped me get outside of my comfort zone. Rachel did this, as we talked about, different flavors of nuclear power technology. I have been, let's say, fairly critical of nuclear as a key part of this energy transition solution in front of us, because I've been so nervous about the regulatory policy challenges as well as the cost implications of that technology. And what she helped me really get was, I would call her and a lot of nuclear proponents these days sort of the new version of the all of the above strategy advocates, which are people saying, look, anything that is zero carbon and producing low-cost energy is something we should be pursuing. And I became a little bit more comfortable with that argument, certainly at least to the point where I didn't want to dissuade founders of going after fission and possibly aspects of fusion, because we can use it all. And with Nan, I was really excited to talk about, can we chemically or human engineer solutions to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere? I have been really negative on this space for a while because the atmosphere is vast. There is a lot of gas out there that we would have to pick apart to really bring the CO2 out of the atmosphere surrounding the Earth. And instead, I've been much more supportive of finding natural solutions to that and trying to amplify those. I'm still pretty much leaning in that direction, but I loved her point of view of effectively we're choosing between a number of not great options in front of us, and we really have to explore every solution possible. So again, in sort of the all of the above mindset, that helped me get closer to that outcome.
I love it. Listening to some of our guests really changed my perspective on nuclear. Before this podcast, I associated it with like scary things like Chernobyl or Fukushima, and I thought of it more as a problem than a solution. And I'm wondering, what do you think it will take for the general public to embrace nuclear to the extent it sounds like we need to?
I don't know if we have enough time to really go through it all on this podcast, but I think these things have to just be mandated. And there are parts of the world like China where it's less of a public debate and discussion and discourse and more of a fiat mandate from on high. I don't think that's a great way to do it, but it's working so far. That's where a lot of new things are happening on the nuclear front. I'd like to see more political discourse on the viability of nuclear in America and in Europe. And if that were to happen in an accelerated timeframe that had real results as outcomes and real educational improvements around the safety and viability from a cost standpoint, I think that would make that a more investable space, and that could ultimately lead it to having a much bigger impact on the climate transition.
Tell me more about what you mean about the political discourse about nuclear power.
Sure. I'm a big fan of electric vehicles. I'm really glad that they are now more than 10% of the global new sales, and I think in the next couple of years, we're going to see a radical acceleration of market share. I don't think there are massive protests of people, you know, marching on Washington saying diesel rules and we should never have electric vehicles. There are people who like their diesel trucks or their cars. but it's not a truly polarizing political issue. Maybe here and there, but it really is not a polarizing issue. Nuclear power has turned into a truly polarizing issue. And in that polarity, I believe that we've lost a lot of rational conversation, a lot of rational ground for discourse. And if there's any chance that modern fission or fusion technologies are going to come to the market, particularly in the U.S. and maybe the U.S. and Europe, we need to have a return to that rational political discourse. And I think a lot of people would roll their eyes at this point and just say, well, that, you know, good luck with that. And I'm a little bit of one of those people. I wish we could, but we should acknowledge that that is a prerequisite to the outcome that we're all seeking. So if people want to work on nuclear power and the implementation of it, they cannot ignore their role in convening safe spaces to have real conversations around the technology and its effectiveness, safety, and cost.
Why do you think nuclear is so polarizing?
It starts with its dual use as a weapon and as this incredible power source. So I think there's fear there, and I think some of that has been really proven to be well-founded. And I think on top of that, there's fear around safety. And then finally, there's a real question around its cost effectiveness. And there's a nuclear facility being built in Georgia right now, which is really proving the point. It's radically over budget. And so I think that we have a lot of work to do to unwind some of that frustration.
Yeah, the fear and the cost. And what advice from our guests, that would be one of the questions we asked everybody, is like, what advice would they give people who wanted to make this leap into working with climate? What advice from our guests resonated the most with you?
Just the acknowledgement that you don't have to go get a nuclear physics degree at MIT to go follow this path, especially decarbonization. It will touch every corner of the global economy. So if you work at Unilever in consumer packaged goods, or you're a farmer, or you are a logger, or you work in a city government job, all of those jobs are going to be touched by climate in the coming decades. And so there are opportunities to make small pivots within your own careers to make sure that you're having that impact and being able to go home and look at your kids in the eyes and explain when they ask, you know, what are you doing now to change things for the future? I think there was a lot of evidence that now more than ever, there are truly great jobs to jump into regardless of your background. So if you were a software salesperson, there are climate software companies that need salespeople. If you're an engineer, there's plenty of jobs in engineering in climate. So I think there was also evidence that you could make the full leap if that was important to you.
One of the guests I really enjoyed was Jason Jacobs because of his optimism. He believes our future is going to be better than our past. And I find that really refreshing, given these uncertain times we live in. Is that a view you share? Like, how do you feel about the future?
Yeah, I just love talking to Jason. He's like the renewable energizer bunny of climate tech. You know, he just like, his conviction is infectious and it's lovely. And he's such a great example on a lot of fronts because he came over from a very non-climate setting, running a really cool health-oriented technology company. But he was hell-bent in making a change once he had sold that company. And I think a lot of people, you know, you have those life-changing events where maybe you build something exciting and sell it and you ask yourself, what's next? A lot of people would go back to the well of, I know how to do that. I'm going to go do that. He did not. He took a massive risk. And in hindsight, I think it looks like a brilliant move. But at the time, I remember talking to him right as he was making that transition. And he sounded like a lot of other folks I've talked to who just felt a urgency and a desire to have an impact. And what I would say is I cherish and appreciate his optimism. I am a little bit sort of short-term pessimistic, long-term optimistic about what's happening to us and our time here on the planet. I think the planet's going to be fine. I'm a little bit worried about humanity, but I think it's going to work out. I mean, I'd say, you know, I recently went to a very rural part of Louisiana, south of New Orleans, that is slowly being flooded from the Gulf of Mexico and is also bears the brunt of many, many storms that come up there and is the conduit for so much of the oil and gas business in the United States. And I talked to a lot of people down there. many of whom work in oil and gas, and some others who just work off the land as hunting and fishing guides. And they, more than many people, I think, feel the delicate imbalance that nature is facing. But they also saw a picture in the future where there would be less reliance on fossil fuels. There might be more electric vehicles, and there also might be a little bit more balance restored to the nature that was around them.
Well, Andrew, one of the things I've loved listening to you do with your guests is a lightning round. And so I'm going to do one with you, if you're okay with that.
Sure.
So I'm going to start with aquaculture. Go.
Amazing potential.
Carbon removal. Can we solve climate change without it?
Well, I would say natural carbon removal, critical, engineered carbon removal, unsolved.
How about green hydrogen?
Unconvinced.
Battery storage.
Critical and an amazing. I believe battery storage continues to be a very investable category.
Nice. So, Andrew, as you know, we always close the show with this question. In hindsight, all great ideas are obvious. Come 2030, and that's only 8 years from now, what are we going to look back on as an obvious idea that today seems crazy?
Electric flight. And possibly, if it has to be a little bit crazier, I would say autonomous electric flight. That will be powerful on so many levels. We'll decarbonize a big part of moving people around, but we'll also unlock mobility because it will be so much more cost effective for people. So I'm really looking forward to this sort of slow advance of electric flight right now turning into a truly transformational part of the economy in probably 5 or 6 years, manifesting itself in really sort of high frequency electric vertical takeoff and landing flight by 2030.
Electric flight. I love it. Well, Andrew, thank you.
Right on. Thank you very much.
That was Andrew Beebe, Managing Director at Obvious Ventures.
And that was Emily Brady, Editorial Director at Obvious Ventures. This is the final episode of our climate series. We hope you came away with a deeper understanding of what's possible in climate tech and how you can make a bigger impact. Obvious Ideas is produced by Obvious Ventures in partnership with Pod People. Obvious invests in purpose-driven founders reimagining trillion-dollar industries. To learn more about us and where we invest, head to obvious.com. Special thanks to our production team, Gabe Kleiman, Aniko Steffen, and Emily Brady from Obvious Ventures, and the team at Pod People, Rachel King, Amy Machado, Emily Shaw, Madison Lusby, and Jason Mack. I'm Andrew Beebe. Thanks for listening.